So we are continuing our study in the book of Job. And last week we spent some time looking through chapter 3. And I wanted to take a good bit of time offering some observations about Job chapter 3. Following our conversation we had last week, I want to basically summarize kind of where I'm at with what we're to take from what Job says, and maybe look forward a little bit and try to understand what he's saying based on how his friends reply and also based on how God responds in Job 38. So I'm going to bounce around just a little bit. So I hope you'll bear with me in that, and we'll work through that. But I really think that the way I understand it, and I'll offer this too, every time I read through Job, my opinion on something shifts a little bit. That's one of the main reasons why I say this isn't an easy study. It's not a study that I would approach and say, here's what it means. It's the kind of study that I think requires us to chew on what we're reading and try to balance it with other things we find in that text, and to try to understand some of the nuances of maybe the relationships that are happening. And I think there's some implications about how we're to understand our relationship with God based on how we see Job respond to his trials. So it's not an easy study for me, but again, I embrace that. I welcome that. And I just want to make sure everybody understands that when I present these ideas, this is my best understanding of Job at this time. If that doesn't seem right, let's talk about it, because that's what we should be doing. I think that we ought to be engaging in fruitful discussion about this. We were out at the Melanocuses last night, and we were sitting around the table together, and some of us started talking about Job, and we were talking through these things, and it was great. And I think that, if I remember correctly, and Kelly, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that we all kind of had a different understanding of it, even leaving that conversation. So, but it was an enjoyable discussion to work through. So I'm going to offer some observations I have about Job chapter 3. I think this chapter is very important to spend time in and understand as best we can what Job is saying. Because again, this is going to frame the rest of the book. This is going to frame the discussions that ensue between Job and his friends. This is paralleled very much in Job chapter 38, and we're going to look at that when God answers Job. And there's a lot going on here, and I want us to not have necessarily a narrow or perfect understanding of what's going on so much as I want us to appreciate the depth and the richness in this text, and the nuances again of how Job is saying what he's saying and the nuances of his friends as they reply. So some observations. Let's get into it. So we talked a little bit last week about what would it be like to be one of Job's friends hearing Job say this stuff, and how it may have been shocking to them to hear this man that they've heard teach and encourage others, as we see Eliphaz is going to get into in chapter 4. He reminds Job how you've encouraged people who have suffered, and now when you're suffering, hey, are you being a little bit hypocritical here? So there's this, what do we make of Job's friend's response? And I want to be clear that I think that it probably would be wisest if I were in this position to just let Job speak. Just let him talk, maybe offer some encouragement, maybe just be like, hey, I don't know why this is happening to you, but just keep trusting in God. I know that much. And maybe leave it at that, but don't try to insinuate things about his character. So there's problems I'm going to try to show with the counsel his friends offer him. And I hope to get into that. Maybe we'll get into it this week, but definitely next week, Lord willing. But I also think if you just look at what Job says in chapter 3 objectively, like, I know that it would be best to just let him talk. But if you look at it just objectively, he says some problematic things. He says some things that are going to provoke this debate between himself and his friends. And he says some things that I believe God addresses directly in chapter 38, and not in a way that says you were right, Job. So just objectively, I think there's some troubling things, and we need to understand why that might be the case. So I also want to say that I think one of the reasons I think Job is so distressed, and he's going to talk about this as we go on, is because God's acting in a way that doesn't make sense to Job. I mean, yes, he's suffering, and that's affecting him. But you think about how well in chapters 1 and 2 he took his suffering. How he even said, like, you know, shall we accept good from God and not accept evil? And he says, naked I came from the womb, naked I shall return. You know, blessed be the name of the Lord. How well he took the news of his suffering when it was fresh and raw. And how it turned into this. And I think part of the reason he's struggling so much is because it just doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense that God is acting this way, the way he sees it. It doesn't make sense. This isn't the God that he's devoted his life to. This doesn't seem like the God. I'll say it's not the God, but it doesn't seem like the God that he's devoted himself to or that he's tried to build a relationship with. So when you have a problem with someone that you love, that you're close to, how do you fix that problem? I mean, the best way to do it is to go talk with them. Right? That usually works better for me than sitting and speculating on what they might be thinking. That works better than talking to my friends about that person. When you have a problem with a person, you go to that person and you talk with them. That's the best way to do it. And I think that's what Job wants to do. That's a natural reaction. When there's a problem between friends, you want to go talk to your friend and work it out. But Job can't do that. He can't just go to God. And I think that's frustrating him. So I think that inability to go just speak with God about what's going on is really distressing Job a lot. And maybe it's what is contributing to him not having a lot of hope. And he's going to say in future chapters, like, I don't have any hope. So it's interesting, too, again, kind of looking forward a little bit in chapters 4 and 5, when Eliphaz replies to him, a lot of that discourse is going to center on that very topic. It's going to talk about, what does man have a right to do when he's at odds with God? Does man have a right to approach God and talk to him about it? So Eliphaz understands what Job's getting at, because that's what Eliphaz is going to talk about. So I think, though, that Job, being a friend of God, he wanted to make things right with him. And I want to talk about why some of these things are problematic in what he says in chapter 3, why they would provoke a debate with his friends. But at the same time, again, this is where the complexity of the book comes in. I think that the way Job speaks also demonstrates a man of great faith. He's a man who was a friend of God. And he's a man who wants to speak with God as a friend and not just go study and get a book answer about what's going on. I think it's a demonstration of his faith. Again, just my take. I may be overthinking all this, but just hear me out and let me know what you think afterwards. So let's look again at what Job's saying in chapter 3. I just want to work through verses 1 through 10 again, which we went through last week. But chapter 3, verse 1, it says, after this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, a man is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. And he goes on and elaborates on the futility and cyclical nature of even the good things in life, how kingdoms can be built, but then they're brought to ruin. And it's a way of devaluing the good things in life that he may even experience. But some of the things we talked about last week that we didn't get into a lot of detail on, but we talked about this imagery that he's using of darkness and how many times he hits that word. He's using the word darkness. And there are some things he uses in here that are associated with darkness. You know, some of the imagery talks about how deep darkness claiming it and clouds dwell upon it. And the idea of darkness bringing with it obscurity. You know, things that are not known happen in the dark, or they don't happen at all, right? And in the dark is where things are not predictable. It's where chaos is. It's where, you know, God has not set things in order, if you will. And he's saying that he wants to not exist. And he could just be elaborating in a poetic way. You know, I think that that's possible here too. But he doesn't just say he wants to die. He says, I wish I'd never been born. Which is a step or two even further than saying he wishes he could just die. So he wishes for non-existence. And I'm going to try to argue that I think this imagery very deliberately challenges what we read back in Genesis chapter 1. So let's jump back there, and I want to try to draw some parallels to it. So Genesis chapter 1, in verses 1 through 19. And just be thinking about some of the things that Job just said as we read through Genesis chapter 1. Starting in verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and he called the darkness night. And there was evening, and there was morning the first day. And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning the second day. And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place. And let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth. And the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning the fourth day. And it goes on. Obviously, there's more to read, but I'm going to pause there for a moment. What I want us to notice is when God created, he did this in some peculiar ways that would have been important or meaningful, especially to people living in the time of Job, because they were surrounded by other nations that worshipped other gods. And what we read about our God, who created, is very different than how these nations understood the origins of their God and how their gods created. In a lot of those cases, their gods were agents of chaos. They didn't take chaos and make order out of it. But the first thing we read about how God created is the spirits hovering over the waters, waters being formless and void. Like, there's nothing here that makes sense. And God makes sense of it. He orders it. So he is someone who is not a product of chance, not a product of chaos, but someone who takes chance and takes chaos and puts it to his use. And it's a commentary on the power of God and of the nature of him compared to a lot of these other gods that they would have heard about. So he does this. And he also, some of the things he creates, I mean, he creates light. And you think about what light represents throughout the pages of the Bible and all the things that are associated with light. I mean, some of the things that come to mind are life. Light and life are all often connected to each other. Purity, goodness, transparency of character, right? We have lots of images in the Bible about how we're to search ourselves and know ourselves and how God searches the thoughts and intentions of man and how his word can divide the thoughts and intentions of our heart. So this idea of light being something that helps us understand what's going on. So, I mean, very simply, you see things that are in the light. You don't see them that are in the dark. And you can apply that analogy to all those things you just talked about. You know, if our hearts are in the dark, we don't understand what's going on in our own hearts. You know, we're not trying. We're trying to maybe conceal things from God rather than be known to God. So darkness and light are in play there. And when God created an existence where he wanted, or he did create an existence where he wanted things to be seen and known and understood, he didn't create an existence of darkness. And perhaps most of all of his creation, God created humans to both understand things and to be understood. So we're told to pursue knowledge and wisdom and again, examine our hearts and our minds and these types of things. So light is something that was very important when God created. And the other thing too is that when you see God creating things, he doesn't create them just so that they are put in order, but he gives a purpose or a job to them. So when God creates, he creates with purpose. You see, like the stars, that's an obvious example. Why did he create the stars? Well, he created them to be a sign for days and months and years. He created them to give light onto the earth. So they have a function. They don't just exist in some orderly fashion, but they serve a role. He had an idea for what he wanted them to do. And likewise, God created us for a purpose. We have purpose. And these things are obvious, but sometimes they're not obvious when you don't kind of match them up with what Genesis 1 is saying. So just to recap some of those basic points, God took chaos and he made order out of it. And he said that was good. And God created light. And he said the light is good. And God gave purpose to his creation. And he said, you know, purpose is a good thing. Purpose is good. So, again, think about how that contrasts some of the things that Job just talked about. Think about how much he dwells on this idea of darkness and clouds and obscurity. And there's a parallel there that I want us to try to see that I think exists for a reason. And I want to go to Job 38 and I want to drive the point home even more. But yes, John?
Which is before there was love. And from that love came this. So Job is looking at his situation, I think, and just really disturbed by everything. He can't quite understand how, if God is a loving God, then how this could happen. But Jesus himself, on the day before people are about to nail him to a tree, this is what he talks about, mm-hmm. with this idea that God, that there was love that existed between God, however that works, right? But that's from that soil came the fruit of this world.
Right, yeah, that pre-existed creation, and it motivated creation, that God would love and then create, and he would love that which he created. I think that's a great observation. And, you know, I think, again, you know, let's not be too hard on Job. I mean, there's 100 reasons why we should be patient with this man who's lost so much. And I think God is being patient with him. And I think God comforts him when we get to the end of the book. I think God loves him very much. But this is why I want to try to get into why this debate even happened. I think that he's saying some things that his friends recognize, like, well, hold on a second. And I'll get to your comments in just a minute. But you think about in chapter 3 again, when he's cursing the day he's born, it's like he's saying, I don't want my creation day to have happened. Let my creation day not be filled with light and order. Let it be filled with darkness and gloominess and clouds. Let it not even happen. Let's not even do that. And in verses 20 and 23, he talks about light specifically. He rebukes the idea that light and life would be given to people who are in misery. Like, he addresses light specifically. Like, I don't want to be in the light if it means misery. That's not good. Light is not good because it shows me misery. And in verse 23, it's interesting because he talks about, I mean, going back to Job chapter 3. Sorry, I'm jumping around. But in Job chapter 3, in verse 23, again, he says, why is light given to man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? And I think when he says he's hedged in, you can understand what he means if you jump ahead to chapter 7 and look at verse 16. In Job 7:16, he says, I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Leave me alone. And I think he's speaking to God. He said, leave me alone, for my days are a breath. What is man that you would make so much of him and that you set your heart on him? Visit him every morning and test him every moment. How long will you not look away from me, nor leave me alone till I swallow my spit? If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? Why have you made me your mark? Why have I become a burden to you? Why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth, but you will seek me, but I shall not be. He feels so scrutinized by God that he's saying, even when I die, it's not going to be enough for God. He's still going to be looking for me to see what else he can do to me. He's not going to find me, but that's not going to stop him from looking. I think that's what Job is saying. So when in chapter 3 he says he's hedged in, he feels trapped. He's like, what can I do? I'm trapped. And it's ironic because you go back to what was the Satan's original complaint to God about Job. He complained that God hedged him in. It's kind of ironic. Of course, the Satan means it in the sense that you've built a protective barrier around him. And Job is saying, you've built a protective barrier around me. Let me out. So some interesting things going on there. I want to go back now to Job chapter 30. But before I do, there were a couple of hands. Kelly?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I just touched on how all of us will go through phases of emotional ups and downs. You know, I believe this is an accurate narrative. I know there's a different opinion about that, but whether Job, this man actually existed, I believe he existed. If this is a narrative about this man's journey, if you will, of the suffering, I think it shows the kind of ups and downs that even people go through. You know, or we might start out strong and then we hit a roadblock. You know?
Yeah. And again, it's not so much for me about scrutinizing every moment of our struggle, but rather recognizing that this struggle is part of the process. And we can get pretty low. I mean, if a man as righteous as Job can get this low, we can get pretty low. And what do we do about it? Do we abandon God? Do we hope that God abandons us? I mean, how many times, like, if you've ever been caught up in some sin, do you just wish God would just stop looking at you? Just, God, don't bother me right now. Just look away. Look somewhere else right now. But that's not how God operates. And he's going to talk to that specifically in chapter 38. Yeah, Billy? It's such a great point because Job, unlike us, doesn't know where this is going. Right? We know where it's going. We've read the book. We can skip ahead to the end of the book and see where it's going, but Job doesn't know it's going there. And some of the things you might say, I mean, think about what's the point in restraining your words when you're on the brink of hopelessness? What? Why not? Why not just, if it feels good in the moment to vent whatever's on your mind, why not do it if there's no hope? I mean, and Job talks to that in chapter 6. He talks about how he's lost hope, so why restrain his words? I'm going to keep going, is what Job says in chapter 6 when we get there. So let's jump ahead and do a little spoiler here in Job 38. Because again, I think it's important for us to understand what Job is saying in chapter 3. And I think chapter 38 helps with that too. So what you're going to find in chapter 38 when the Lord answers Job is that God first goes back to creation. Just like we read in Genesis chapter 1, he goes back to the creation. And you can see the tone in God's voice is going to be obvious. It's obvious that he's not in agreement with what Job said. So he's speaking about his creation and he's doing it in a way that suggests Job has challenged him. Okay, so I think we should understand that there's a challenge that Job is issuing a little bit in chapter 3. All right, so let's look at verses 4 through 21 just to get some of these verses in. Job 38, verse 4, God says, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk, and who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors, when it burst out from the womb? When I made clouds its dark, its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed limits for it, and set bars and doors, and said, 'Thus far you shall come, and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed.' Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken. Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all of this. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory and that you may discern the paths to its home? You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great, he says sarcastically. Do you see some things in there that remind you of what Job was saying? There's a lot of same wording being used here. If you look, like, let's jump back to Job chapter 3 and look at verse 9. I just want to compare some of these similarities. In Job chapter 3, verse 9, Job says, "Let the stars of its dawn," meaning the day of his death, "be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning." This idea of the stars of the dawn not having any reason to exist or to hope or have joy. And then you go over to Job chapter 38 and verse 7, and God says, in verse 6, he says, "On what were its bases sunk, or who laid its cornerstone, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" And then jump back to Job chapter 3 and verse 10. Job, continuing his thought, he said that, "Let the stars of its dawn be dark," in verse 9 and verse 10, "because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes." So Job's saying he wishes the doors for his mother's womb to be shut so that life would be prevented. His life would be prevented. But then go back to Job chapter 38 in verses 8 through 10. And God says, "Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb?" Same kind of imagery, right? "When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band and prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors." The thought being there that God shut the doors to the womb of the sea, the way he's describing it here. And he did that to preserve life, not to prevent life from happening, but to preserve it. So go back to Job chapter 3 and verse 6, just another example. When Job says, "That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of months." And then, again, we kind of looked at it already, but Job chapter 38 and verse 9, again, has a lot of this same imagery. So in Job 3:6, Job is wishing for this thick darkness to seize life, is the way he says it, which, again, means prevent it from happening. And then in Job 38:9, God talks about how he made clouds the sea's garment and thick darkness its swaddling band. Again, meaning like he caused it to not flow chaotically and preserve life by doing that. So a lot of the same images that Job uses to talk about how he wishes life would be prevented, his own life, God uses to talk about how he's preserving life. So there's kind of a connection there, and the same imagery is kind of used in both of those. And there's more connections that can be made. That's just several of those. So, but we also see that God not only created and gave order and gave purpose, but he also sustains his creation. He's actively involved in it. And we jump down in Job chapter 38, verses 39 through 41. Just as one example of this. He says, "Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions? When they crouch in their dens or lie in wait for their thicket, who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God for help and wander about for lack of food?" So God's saying, "I'm helping. I didn't just create, but I'm helping. I'm doing things for this creation that I made because I care for it. And if I care for the lions, if I care for the ravens, the implication is, Job, don't I care for you?" So I've argued that Job just wants God to leave him alone and let him die. But what God is saying here in these verses is the opposite of leaving his creation alone. It's like, no, when my creation is at the brink of death, I go find food for it. I help it. And God wants Job to see how creation benefits from his involvement. It's like, I read this as God saying, like, Job, you don't really want a creation that's just governing itself with its creator stepping back and just letting things happen. You don't really want me to look away. And in a sense, you know, it's possible God could be implying that, you know, Job, you ought to know this better than anyone based on your recent experience. I mean, being on your own, having no hope, having no help, what's that doing for you? And again, like Billy said, we get the benefit of having this whole thing. We can go back to and read it and make some applications from it. But I think God wants us to understand this. It's better if God's involved in our life and not just letting us be on our own. That seems like an obvious point, but I think it's an important point that we're going to get from this. But let's take it one step further. Think back again on the challenge that Satan issued to God. When you think about that, remember how when God pointed out Job as being exemplary, it kind of offended the Satan? He said, yeah, he's great because you basically protect him from everything, which basically means he's not great. Satan didn't really appreciate how God seemed to enjoy having a relationship with this man. And I would argue that the Satan was somewhat effective in getting Job to wish the same. Because by the end of it, Job is saying, I don't want to be where God is. Isn't that kind of Satan's plan from the very beginning? Let's drive a wedge between these two. I don't like what's happening here. And I think we're going to see this more when we get into chapter 4 and 5. When we read about this shadowy figure that appears to Eliphaz at night. And he's going to talk about some of these things. This shadowy figure is going to try to plant these ideas in Eliphaz's mind. Who is man that he could approach God? God finds fault with his servants in his throne room and his angels. Who are you? Who are you? So the Satan didn't want God to think highly of man, and he reduces Job to the point of wishing that the relationship would just go away and for him to not even exist. But let's make sure we understand the point. If God were to grant Job's wish to just let him die or not exist, then the Satan wins, doesn't he? And I think we can see a parallel in our own lives here. You know, we see how sometimes our adversary, the devil, wants us to isolate ourselves from God, like I alluded to before. And if you're caught up in some sin, do you want to be where God is? Like in your heart, really? I haven't at times in my life. It would be better just be like, I don't want to think about God right now. Let's just put some distance there. But that's not what God wants. And it's not what he's wanted from the beginning. He doesn't want to look away because it's better for his creation if he doesn't look away. And then bigger picture, you know, if God just left us alone to do whatever we want, then our adversary, the devil, wins. He wins. So interesting parallels here. Few closing thoughts. I know we're almost out of time. Thank you for letting me do most of the talking. We'll have a little bit more back and forth next week as we start chewing on chapters 4 and 5. These are just some things maybe we can chew on over the next week. I think that what Job is stating here about what he wants, I think what he wants is wrong. And I think it's pretty obviously not aligned with what God wants for Job. And I also think that, like with most situations in real life, what you often get from people is a mixed bag of good and bad. I think there's a lot of good that you can take from Job's character, even in his criticisms, because he's a man who demonstrates, man, I love God, and I don't know what he's doing to me. And his friends, on the other hand, you know, a lot of their responses, when we look at this, they're going to give some pretty scriptural answers, if you allow me to use that term. Like, they're right on. Kind of like, okay, remove context from this situation and some of the points they're making, they're right on. In fact, some of the things they say, you can go to other verses and almost read the exact same thing that they're saying. So they're right on. But I think that in a sense, even though they have some good scriptural advice, maybe, the tension there is that Job has experience on his side. Because what they're saying is it aligns with what other scriptures teach. But here's Job saying, I'm not guilty of any of that. So tell me what's going on now. I hear what you're saying, but that's not what this is. And they're like, well, it has to be because that's what it says. And he says, okay, but it's not. And it escalates. So think about that. Think about how there's kind of a difficulty in understanding who's right and who's wrong, because in a sense, each side is right, and in a sense, each side is wrong. Okay? And I think that also, in my limited experience, has contributed to conflict I personally experienced in my life. When you have two people who are right in some ways and wrong in some ways, and maybe they don't see how they're wrong, but they do see how they're right. So one other point of attention to consider when we chew on this, when we think about Job, you know, there's tension presented here in how much am I to consider myself a friend of God versus how much am I to consider myself an unworthy servant? Because the Bible speaks to both. Is Job an unworthy servant of God? Yeah. Does he deserve anything from God? No. But is he also a friend of God? And what do we do when those things seem to conflict? Like, the way it may play out is like when you're struggling with something that maybe you don't agree with what God wants you to do in some area, how much of liberty do you take in expressing your frustration to God about this thing? Versus how much do you just take on the servant's role and say, I just need to get my heart and my mind straight? And I think there's times for both. It's tension, right? I mean, there's no easy answer to that, at least not for me. That's the kind of thing that I'm hoping that as I chew on it and meditate on it and pray about it, that I'll get better at discerning the difference. But that tension is here, right? How much is Job allowed to vent, give full vent of his frustration to God versus when does he go too far and need to remember his place? Kelly? Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things we talked about last night is, you know, Jesus suffered immensely and he did it as a servant to God. He did it because it was his Father's will to do it. But I mean, if that hadn't been laid upon him, would he have chosen to suffer that way? I don't think so. He did it because that was his Father's plan and he was going to carry it out. So anyway, interesting stuff. Thank you very much for your attention. We'll go ahead and stop there. Next week, I've run out of things to talk about in chapter 3, so by necessity, we have to go into chapter 4. So be ready. Go ahead and read like chapters 4 through 7, because you'll get a bigger context of what Eliphaz has to say and how Job replies to it. And we'll talk about that next week, Lord willing. Thank you.